I'd like to call your attention this morning to a scripture that we'll start with and we'll maybe circle back to, but I'd like to dig out a few things about the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy chapter 10, as you're turning there, I'll give you a little bit of background about what's going on in Deuteronomy. If you remember, Deuteronomy is the fifth book of Moses, so if you'll look in your King James Bible, when you look at the beginning of the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, then Deuteronomy, those five books, it'll say under Genesis, the first book of Moses called Genesis, and then Exodus, the second book of Moses called Exodus, so on and so forth. These are the five books that Moses was the author. He wrote these things, which is sort of kind of interesting. Of course, when you think of Genesis, all that, you know, the entire book of Genesis covers the largest share of human history in the Bible was written by a man who lived way after all that stuff. So it was a historical text that he wrote, and then more in his present time, he wrote Exodus, Numbers, Leviticus, and of course Deuteronomy. And it's often called the Pentateuch, penta meaning five, and the Jews still reverence it as kind of their basic history book, their starting point, the place they go for a lot of information about what it means to be Jewish. In Deuteronomy, deuter means two. So Deuteronomy is really kind of a two. It's the second time that you're kind of going through the law that was given to Moses and recounting things. And certainly in the first few chapters, what Moses is doing is recounting the history of Israel. He goes in and recounts how that the Lord brought them out of Egypt and some of the different things, trials and tribulations they underwent, things like that. In chapter 10, as he goes through that, he talks about the journey and the setting aside of the Levitical priesthood. But down in verse 12 of chapter 10, he says these words, "And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes which I command thee this day for thy good." As we see in these verses, he says, you can sum all this stuff up in just a few little things. You can say, what does the Lord require of the Israel? As you get ready to move on, as you get ready to do those things the Lord has given you, because he's given you all that, those laws and those commandments and those statutes, but what's he really asking of you? It's very simple. He says he requires that you fear the Lord thy God, you walk in his ways, that you love him, and that you serve him with all thy heart and with all thy soul. So to keep the commandments of the Lord, his statutes, which he commanded thee, it's for thy good that he does these things. Now, let's back up and kind of think about that just a little bit. The Old Testament law, of course, we really love reading all the minutiae and the different things they had to do. You know, if you're ever you know, having trouble falling asleep at night or things like that, you can always open up. And if you're just not into reading the lineages of somebody begat somebody, you can always read the Old Testament law, and that'll pretty much put you to sleep. As you're wondering, what was God thinking when he gave all this to these Jews? And it is very meticulous. But laws were necessary. Laws were necessary with the nation of Israel, and God gave those laws. But every nation needs a certain law. And matter of fact, the very definition of civilization itself, if you look in an old dictionary, now if you look in a modern dictionary, I don't know what you're going to find. You might find some really crazy definitions. But if you were to get a true Oxford Old English dictionary and you were to look up the word civilization, it's going to tell you a codified set of laws that define, you know, behavior and civility, if you will. And in fact, civil law by definition in an old dictionary literally means the Roman law that applied to the citizens of Rome. That's what it really means. It actually, and then of course it's got definition number two and so on and so forth. But the first and primary definition of civil law is Roman laws that applied to the citizens of Rome so they would know what was acceptable and unacceptable in the Roman Empire. And they had a civilization, if you will. Same's true for every great civilization. They had to have laws, because without those laws, you just have anarchy. Everybody just does whatever they want to do. It's just chaos and survival of the fittest, and sometimes not even survival of the fittest. It's just survival, one over the other. And that's happened in times past, and those societies, if you will, they don't last in a situation like that. So you must have laws in order to keep order and to establish what's good and what's not good. Interestingly enough, God, of course, gave laws to Moses and laws of Israel, but there's different categories that he gave. If you recall and you read through all that, you find out that he gave, you know, civil law. He also gave dietary law. He gave laws about what was allowed to be eaten and what was not allowed to be eaten and how it was to be prepared, how, you know, kind of the sanitary means, if you will, about diet and things like that, amazingly enough. You know, and we see some of that today. Now, we certainly balk at that, but, you know, if you go to New York City and you order, you know, any kind of soft drink or, you know, our Coke product, since we live in Atlanta, if you buy any kind of Coke up there and they put it in something like a 64-ounce cup, you might just end up in jail because that's illegal to be drinking that. No, that actually, although the mayor of Bloomberg tried that, that didn't last too long because that's, you just can't regulate how much Coke people drink and some other things like that. Even if there are health benefits by not drinking so much of that. That being said, God did regulate what the children of Israel could eat and could not eat, things like that. So he had civil law, dietary law. Certainly he had a moral law, which we would refer to more as criminal law. You know, that moral law, he does not allow you to steal. That's a moral law. It is immoral to be stealing from folks, things that you don't own. It is immoral to commit adultery, if you will. That was another moral law. God defined those things for them. He also defined religious law, too. A little unusual, but he did define religious law on how they were to worship, how they were to conduct their religion, what was allowed and what was not allowed from a religious standpoint. So civil law, dietary law, religious law, moral law. Now, of these different categories, and you know, Bible students, think about this, which one of those laws did Israel as a nation, most consistently break or dishonor or just not respect and not quite live up to those things? And I know when I looked at that, and if you really think about this, they actually were pretty good. You know, the whole part of being a Jew was keeping the law, right? You know, that was in the New Testament times, Paul, Peter, the other Jews of that time period, and the people that Jesus Christ interacted with, one of the main things that they would often say is how well they kept the law, how Jewish they were, defined by what they did in keeping the law. But more times than not, as I read through my Bible and read about the Israelites, the category of law that they more than often broke or did not keep was the religious law. It was the religious law. They just seemed to have trouble with that. How you're supposed to worship, what's allowed, what's not allowed, you know, that you continually do things. You do things that God has set down in the religious law. And, of course, remember, what does Moses say? All these things, all these commands and statutes were given for their good, not to restrict them, not to just be, you know, overbearing. I know sometimes we as parents, sometimes with our children just think that we're just, you know, the meanest parents on the planet. And that's true. We are. And I'm proud of it, by the way. I'm glad to be the meanest parent on the planet. I want to have that title because that tells me I'm probably doing my job right because I'm not letting them do the things that would get them into trouble. That's what defines me as being mean. I won't let them get in trouble. I said one time recently that when my girls were little, as far as what's the politically correct word? Corporal punishment. Yeah, I think that's what it's called. Anyway, we didn't call it that when I was growing up. We had lots of other better words than that, and they those words tended to describe the pain that was inflicted with that kind of punishment. Like I said, my dad hit for distance. my wife and I both, when the girls were little, there was really only about two things that without you know, without any trial, without any discussion, without anything, that elicited immediate discipline that we would call corporal punishment. One was outright, just flat out rebellion. You know, you've been told to do something five times, you still rebel to do it, and you're gonna suffer the consequences. And I know different parents have different tolerance limits. Ours may, you know, some of us are real short, a couple of times and you're done. Others 10 times. Either way, you know, at some point, rebellion, you're going to be disciplined for that. So that sin of outright defiant rebellion, that's the one you're looking for. Now, that's not, you know, sweetie, push your milk a little closer on the table because you're going to knock it over, and then they do it anyway. That's not rebellion. That's a kid being a kid, and but for the grace of God, I would have done the same thing. So, you don't want to. It's not that. It's just that outright defiant rebellion against your commands and things like that. But the other one that would elicit the most emotional roller coaster response from parents is when they jeopardize their own safety, when they willingly, through their own disobedience, jeopardize their safety. So when you had little ones, and you're walking out of Walmart into that parking lot, and you say, hold my hand, or if your hand's full, you say, grab onto my pocket, or grab onto my coat, or my pants, or whatever, but I want you to hold on to me. You're not going to run wild through the parking lot, are you? And you tell them, but see, you don't explain all these details to them. You say, hey, hold my hand, or sweetie, hold on to my, I used to have the girls hold on to my pants, something like that. If my hands were full, or I had to push the buggy or something like that. And they had to stay lockstep with me and be right there with me, right? That's fine. But if they wanted to disobey that, well, that disobedience wasn't, emotionally about their disobedience so much is when they disobeyed me, the result was they put themselves in danger because now you have a little kid that you can't see when a car's backing up, that you can't see that's darting out between cars all of a sudden in a parking lot, and that puts them at risk, and that will not be tolerated. That's where dad gets very, very angry, and so they have to realize that it's their safety that I'm concerned with. Is it any, if I'm being, like Paul says, he says, look, if we being sinful mortal men are that way toward our children, imagine how much more a thrice holy God feels toward us when we disobey him, but that disobedience compromises our safety or our well-being or our spiritual health. Imagine how he wants to deal with us, and that's just not tolerated. That's that religious law, like I said. When you're breaking the religious law, you're compromising your own safety. Now, just as an example to tell you about some of these other laws, I just want to get this in your mind. The moral law was pretty straightforward. They all kind of got that, and that lasted. A good example of that is, King David broke the moral law outright. And when the lowly prophet Naaman came up and accused him of both adultery and murder, breaking those moral laws, you committed adultery, then you committed murder to cover it up. Nobody said, now wait a minute, we got to have some religious tolerance here. No, they didn't say that because it wasn't religious law. Everybody got it. Yep, David, that's wrong. We know that's wrong. We don't even, in some circles, I think people would even say they didn't even need the Old Testament law of Moses to figure that one out. That was just wrong. But it was codified. If you realize, those were two commandments in the Ten Commandments. So right off the bat, there was two out of the ten he had really messed up on. Actually, there was a third one in there as well. And I could probably argue a fourth or fifth in there as well. So David just had a heyday breaking God's moral law. This is criminal activity, and it is subject to death in some instances. There was no problem with that. In fact, it wasn't even just the Israelites that realized, David, you broke the law, and it's wrong what you did. We can actually read over in Romans, the second chapter, which quotes back into the New Testament, has a quote back in the New Testament, points out that particular breaking of God's law, it actually gave the Gentiles occasion to blaspheme. In other words, the Gentiles recognized that was wrong. Gentiles in the day of David recognized that what this king of Israel did was against God's law, but the fact that he did it said, well, if the king of Israel can thumb his nose at the moral law of God, then I guess so can we. It gave them an excuse to sin. So that was one of the other things that David did by his actions. Now, dietary law, obviously the dietary law was something that the Jews religiously kept. They equated that with religious law. It wasn't religious law. It's dietary law. And I know one of my pastors when I was growing up was an Elder Aaron Flowers. Elder Flowers served over 26 years in the United States Navy. He was a young man from the hills of Tennessee that when he was about 16 or 17 years old, literally ran away from home and joined the Navy. And the next thing he knew, after finishing his basic training up at Great Lakes in the early 40s, found himself in the middle of World War II. And because that's kind of the age period he was at. So when he was a young man, about 17, 18 years old, his first duty station was go to San Francisco, where he was going to board a ship called the USS Hornet. And while he was there getting ready to get with the ship's company and get the Hornet ready to sail out of San Francisco Bay, and of course Pearl Harbor had already occurred, so we were already at war, and he's ready to go off. He's 1,000 miles from Tennessee, not knowing what's coming next. And of course, he watched as they loaded Army B-17 bombers on the deck of that, thinking, what are we doing? Well, obviously, we must be transporting. We're just an overgrown transport ship transporting these big Army B-17 bombers maybe out to the Pacific or something, to a Pacific base. But, you know, we're a giant carrier, so the USS Hornet was a big old giant carrier. And, of course, as you know from your history, what he was doing was witnessing not just a transport. Those were live bombers. And there was a group of Army Air Corps led by a Colonel Doolittle that was going to fly those over Tokyo and make the very first strike. And so that was how he started World War II, is launching Doolittle and his raiders. And, of course, they never saw them again because they just kept on going and they had to make it back to safe lines on their own. But that was the very first strike over Tokyo, which is a very famous event that occurred. Movies. Go see the Van Johnson one. That's the good one, the black and white. Although Van Johnson's redheaded, but you see that movie, that's the best one. And then from there, he was at the Battle of Midway, Battle of Coral Sea, every major engagement in the Pacific. That being said, his rate in the Navy was, he was in the dietary. He was a mess specialist. So he was in the galley cooking food and preparing that and kind of coordinating all that. So his training through the Navy was about dietary needs. And he would often talk to me about the dietary laws of the Jews. He goes, these are all are almost identical to the same things we were held to when I was in the Navy about the preparation and cleanliness and sanitizing food and equipment, stuff like that. Because if you didn't do all those things that were contained in those laws, you could easily have a mass stomach virus or mass epidemic among an entire nation of these nomadic people going around. So he said, that's all just make sense stuff. That God didn't just make this stuff up to be weird. This was all good stuff for them so that they didn't get sick on their travels, so that they kind of stayed healthy as they walked around through the wilderness and went into the land to possess it. Those were all designed for their good, for their benefit. He said those dietary laws make perfect sense to him as someone that's been that deal. Civil law was the kind of more their customary stuff. Civil law, really, in the Old Testament, is more about how do people address issues between ourselves? How do we resolve issues among ourselves? And the Old Testament's full of those kinds of things, those civil laws that if you were to, unfortunately, if you were to borrow somebody something and it were to be destroyed, it's like you borrowed their ox to plow your field because you need an extra ox to plow your field, and then that ox became lame, you had to shoot it, something like that. You've got to repay that and then some. You know, that was civil law that prescribed a restoration to your neighbor or things like that. Or if there was an issue over maybe a property line or something like that, then there was the civil law among the Jews prescribed that you would go before the judges of that city, and you would state, each one would state their case, and the judges would decide, and they would, as it says, and actually it was in Deuteronomy chapter 25, where he states that, it says those judges or elders of that city had the authority to justify the one and condemn the other if there was some dispute that was going on, because you had to be real careful about that. It was actually a consequence about false dispute. So they had to be very careful about making false accusations against your neighbor knowingly, and the judges could determine that. So they would keep the civil law. That became custom. You know, that was the custom of the Jews. Even in the days of Jesus Christ, it was often customary to do certain things on certain days or certain ways. They kept those Jewish customs. And again, they worshiped all that custom as religion, even though it wasn't. They worshiped dietary law as religion, even though that's not it was. Even the moral law itself, when I say religious law, I'm not talking about, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal. I'm talking about prescribed way that they're supposed to worship the Lord. Remember, they could bring certain sacrifice of certain things and do certain things and not do certain things. There was the whole sanctification process. Only the priests could go into the holy place or the holiest of holies. Those were all the religious laws, and you didn't violate that. So those encompass that. Now, what happens now? We're in the New Testament kingdom. We don't have to worry about any of that stuff, right? All that stuff's just taken care of. We can just wipe it off the books, and we're just free to do whatever we want to. Anybody that thinks that doesn't quite get the idea of what was going on in the Old Testament. They don't quite get the idea. In fact, let me pose this. Ten Commandments, right? So Ten Commandments, they were repeated here in Deuteronomy. In fact, the very first chapter 10, the first thing that Moses talks about is about how that, you know, they had broke the Ten Commandments the first time. Not only had they broke those actual commandments when he came down from the mountain and found out that they had made an idol. So commandment number two, thou shalt make no graven image. Commandment number one, thou shalt have no other gods before me. They did both of those in one sitting. And who knows what else they were breaking at the time. It really doesn't matter. Number one, number two, right off the bat, broken. Moses saw that. And so not just symbolically, but literally, he cast those stones down, and those big old stones, they break as well. So the law was not only literally broken by the children of Israel, it was physically broken as two tablets of stone that God himself had written those laws on. So that was bad. But then what God did is says, let's renew that. He said, Moses, here's what I want you to do. You carve out two tablets of stones just like the first. You carve those out. And you make something that you can carry those because they're kind of heavy. You make them and you carry them back up in the mountain and you present those stones before me and I'll do it again. I'll write my laws back on those. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to secure them this time. I want you to take them and then put them in the Ark of the Covenant beneath the mercy seat. Put those two tablets in there and you secure them in there. Obviously, just as a side, this is a perfect side. Every time you think about that, you know, think about your pastor as a lawyer who explains to you law and how that works and how those two tablets of stone. Remember, Brother John challenged on one time, and that was just one of those eye-opening things for me as well. I know it was for you. It's an eye-opening thing for me. It's something I just treasure. I look at it because it fits so perfectly. The Lord knows what he's doing when he does stuff. Remember, Brother John asked you how many of the Ten Commandments were written on each tablet. You had two tablets. And of course, we all want to think, because of our little bookmarks we get from Zondervan's, we want to think that there's five on the left one and five on the right. There is not. There's 10 on the left and 10 on the right. Same. They are duplicates. And I see, and once Brother John said that, it's like, yes, this is how contractual law works. God made a covenant contract. It's a covenant. Here is the covenant. He writes it down, both of them, 10 laws. One original copy is for you to keep, and one original copy is for him to keep. So both parties of the covenant have two signed, executed original copies. That's how that's done. I do this all the time at my job. We often enter into contracts with vendors or businesses, and this is exactly what we do. I have to print out, and our legal team, our general counsel, tells us to do this. They say, okay, it's all been reviewed, we're all good, we all agree to all the terms and conditions in this contract now. And they tell me, and I read it online or whatever, they send me an email that says, print out two clean copies and get both of them signed by all parties in the places indicated. And so usually I have to send it off to the vendor, and whoever's going to sign it for them signs and dates and all that kind of stuff. And then I get it back, both copies, and then I send it up the route where there'll be some initials. And oftentimes, because of the dollar amount that I'm dealing with, our CEO has to sign. So it's a lady. She has to sign in her spot. I take one copy and I send it back off to the vendor and say, here's your copy signed by us and you. And then I keep our copy and put it in our legal repository so we can always reference it. That's exactly the way I do it. So that made perfect sense when Brother John said that. Moreover, what happened the first time is there was a party in this agreement. First go round, like I said, party in this agreement did not keep the first two terms of that agreement. So over. It's done. That agreement is no longer valid because one of the parties can't keep their end of the bargain. One of those parties can't keep the terms spelled out on both of those tablets, and that would be us. That would be the children of Israel and us. We could not keep the terms there. We broke it. Therefore, the Lord is not obligated to do anything under that agreement. Right? Right. However, he renewed that, and he says, look, I got a solution to this little problem. What you need is you need a representative that's authorized to sign for all of you folks and that can keep that for you, that'll keep that for you, keep it safe. And you know what? I'm going to appoint myself a representative, too. I'll appoint myself a representative. You appoint a representative. We'll appoint a representative. We'll go to arbitration on this thing. We'll appoint a representative. You appoint a representative. I'll appoint a representative, and they'll keep both tablets. They'll keep both original copies, one on your behalf, one on my behalf. And as long as that stays tried and true, as long as that stays kept, then the covenant's good forever. So what did God tell Moses to do with those? He said, you bring those tablets, I'll write it again. And then what I want you to do is take those two tablets and secure them in the Ark of the Covenant beneath the mercy seat. A perfect, perfect type and shadow of Jesus Christ himself. So here's what we're going to do. We, as the children of the living God, will appoint one representative. His name will be Jesus Christ. He will sign it and keep it on our behalf, right? And God will appoint one legal representative, His Son, His heir, who has full power of attorney, full, durable, eternal power of attorney. That's a legal term, by the way. He has authorized the Lord Jesus Christ, the eternal and only Son of God, to be His representative and sign on His behalf and keep it on His behalf. You see, it's the same guy. We got the same representative. He appointed His Son, and we appointed our Savior. And it's the same guy, and He is that Ark of the Covenant. He is that mercy seat, and He has kept that law perfectly and forever. What a beautiful type and shadow of our Lord Jesus Christ and what He did. But He kept both original copies, didn't He? Our copy and the Lord's copy. So that covenant's good forever, because we know what our Lord Jesus Christ is capable of doing. I use a lot of time doing that, but that's a beautiful picture. You need to hear it anyway, so you can take that one home. Now, in the kingdom of God, what laws do we have? We have plenty of laws. We have plenty of things we're supposed to keep. There's all kinds of little rules that we have in the New Testament church. I wrote down just a few of them here. In Titus chapter 3, Titus tells us, a man that is a heretic after the first and second admonition, reject. We as a church body are to note a person who is a heretic, someone who's bringing in something that's unsound, something that's against the laws of God, or something that would subvert us from what we believe and the basis where we believe it. And for us, for Old Baptists, this is a pretty straightforward thing. Other folks might have a little trouble defining heretic. We don't have any trouble whatsoever. We can do that just like that. Why? Because we have a solid foundation in Jesus Christ. And any time that you tell us something that diminishes the power, the majesty, the glory of Jesus Christ and what He accomplished, any time you try to put a chink in His armor, any time you try to take our eyes upon the cross of Jesus Christ and what was accomplished there and the power that's in the cross, anytime you do that, you're dangerously committing heresy. You're in danger right there. And if you're adamant that that ain't the way, I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of what I mean. There was, and of course, only Old Baptists. Old Baptists are the best heretics there are, by the way. We're the only ones that really come up with the really, really good heresies. Back several years ago, probably in the 60s, late 60s or so, and this is not something new. It kind of bubbled up like a volcano. Oh, and by the way, all the heresies are from Texas. Brother Bryce and I had this conversation while he was here. I said, do you realize that? Actually, I told Brother John that. I was telling Brother John, I said, look, Brother John, when you go back to Texas and you preach at Oak Hill, I said, you'll get with Brother Dickie Hoggywox. You tell Brother Dickie, God, if I ever had the opportunity to go preach at Oak Hill, I think for a series of meetings like that, for every sermon, I pick a different heresy that you Texas preachers came up with and address that. And of course, Brother Dickie would say, well, then you're not going to get invited because we don't really want to hear how bad we are. But anyway, but I told Brother John just to do that for Brother Dickie. But there was an idea that was put forth several years ago that the atonement for the sins of God's people was accomplished not at the cross, but in the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, why would someone say that? Because in the Bible, it said when He was there and He was praying, quote, and He sweat, as it were, drops of blood while He was praying. In other words, the intensity of Jesus Christ alone in that Garden of Gethsemane before the hour that He knew, before He knew this, He knew the hour is come. It is time. He had lived for some 33 and a half years on this planet, the last three and a half years or so in His ministry, setting up His kingdom on behalf of His Father, but it was time to depart. It was time to leave it in the hands of His appointed apostles and go and be offered up on a cross and suffer a cruel and painful death. Not just that, the shame, the suffering, the whipping, just everything that would occur to Him. He knew that He must suffer and bleed and die and undergo all that. And He was in that garden praying. He was having a moment with His Heavenly Father. And it says in the Bible, it tells us, quote, and He sweat. Because it was intense. I mean, this was intense. I don't know if you're like me, if you get nervous enough, you start sweating. Remember the commercial, don't let them see you sweat? That's a real thing. Well, this was so intense that He sweat, as it were, drops of blood. What the writer's trying to tell you is give you a picture. It's a word picture to tell you that blood is real thick. and it drops very slowly and makes a sound when it drops. Blood's kind of a thick, heavy substance. That's what it's trying to tell you, is literally that it was so intense and stuff. He's not physically doing anything. That's the other thing, is you got to realize. Now, if I'm out, you know, we're out playing basketball outside on a hot, humid day in Georgia, we're going to sweat, right? It's going to roll off of it, a little bit here, a little bit there, whatever. And it's just, we're going to just like perspire a lot. That's not what he was doing. He wasn't just perspiring a lot. It's his sweat, and it was on his forehead, not his brow, and it was very thick. It was thick because of the intensity of the emotion that he was feeling at that point. But out there in Texas, there was a preacher, and then essentially a group of preachers that said, no, it wasn't just as drop of blood. In other words, a simile. You boys know what that is. Like and as, making that simile. Remember that? So it wasn't just a simile in the English language. It was drops of blood. Therefore, he was shedding blood for the remission of sins. They concluded that based on that verse, that little phrase. Obviously, they missed a little point there about the English language and about how it's a similar metaphor, that kind of thing. That being said, that was heresy. That's heresy. That's easy. Why? Because it diminished what he accomplished on the cross. It took away. It said sin wasn't atoned for on the cross. It was atoned for in the garden. And we're saying, no, it wasn't. Because Paul didn't believe that. That's why he showed up at Corinth and says, you know, I want to know nothing but Jesus Christ, him crucified. That's why he constantly said to the folks at Philippi, he says, I crucify myself daily. I'm crucified. In other words, he pointed to the cross constantly as the place of power, as the place where something was accomplished, as a place we look to. We can take the sins that so easily beset us and leave them there in the blood of Christ, where they are atoned for and put away as far as the east is from the west. So see, Paul and Peter and those other apostles, they didn't have that problem. It took 2,000 years and a Texas preacher to have that problem. So I know, poor Texas. I'm from Texas. I can do that. Heresy's easy. So like I said, those are the kinds of things that occur that we refer to in that sense, and we're not to put up with that. But we are supposed to labor a couple of times with them before we reject them. Another one that I like. But fornication, all uncleanliness, this is Ephesians chapter 5, but fornication, all uncleanness, covetous, let it not be what name once among you as it become a saint. There was a thing that happened several years ago, many of you remember. There was another Christian church. There was another Christian church that was dealing with these kinds of things. Fornication, sexual misconduct, if you will, covetousness, uncleanliness. Which is deviation, deviant. There was a church trying to deal with that, and they came out with a policy that when they found that their ministers were doing this, and this would also apply to any of the lay people as well, it was kind of a three strikes thing. So you could do it, you could be forgiven, you could do it again, you could be forgiven, but third strike, you're out. So they came out with a three strikes rule, and some of you may remember that. It was in the news and stuff. There was a three strikes rule among one of our, other Christian denominations. They're our brothers. They're our brothers. Don't get me wrong. That's our brothers and sisters too. Would to God they were all old Baptists so they could not worry about stuff like that. But that being said, this is the verse that came to my mind. It's like, wait a minute. Don't you understand? In the New Testament church, under the authority of God himself, Paul wrote down to the Ephesian church, let it not once be named among you. There is no three strikes. It's once in your history. This will not once be tolerated in the New Testament church. So there's obviously some laws here that God wants us to follow for our own good. Now, let me ask you this. When these laws are broken, we understand as old Baptists, and we're accused oftentimes of being pretty harsh about this, and I will say, yes, there have been times and generations where we as a people were exceedingly harsh on the application of some of these laws. Not for lack of zeal on the part of those saints that were generations before me for wanting to follow the Lord, but they sort of missed the point of how the New Testament is structured and how it works. And that's what I hope to get to as we finish up. The point of this is if there's a rebellion and you're breaking one of these New Testament laws like this, there's several others. There's rules around how a bishop is supposed to be. You know, when I was ordained and Brother John was ordained, there was some preacher that was, one of our other preachers was chosen to stand up. And while we sat before the congregation or sat before that preacher, they went through one or more texts in the Bible and asked someone else, They didn't ask me, and they didn't ask Brother John when he's ordained. They asked someone else that knows us well, and they went through and say, do we meet those qualifications? Those are rules. Those are laws. And as an ordained minister, we are obligated under those laws. Now, what that means is something that's a little bit upsetting to some of our own ministers. I'm more than happy to sit down in love and talk to them about this. And Brother John and I have had this discussion and said, you know, sometimes we think when that was done at our ordination, when those things are read, it's what we call a punctiliar action. It's a one-time thing. You take the test, you passed, you had a passing grade, you can be ordained as a minister. You know, stuff like, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior, given to hospitality, apt to teach. Those are a few out of 2 Timothy that are required. Those are requirements to be ordained as a minister, right? Those are not punctiliar. They are for the rest of your natural life. And if you decide you want to break one of those, then the church is authorized to take action and remove your credentials as a minister and anything else they think is necessary. But they are authorized to do that because this goes on. And that's kind of disconcerting for some men to realize that. Well, what if I've decided that I don't want to be apt to teach? Well, that's not optional. Sorry. What if I don't want to be the husband of one wife? Well, that's not optional either. Are you kidding me? Why do you want another wife? You don't know what to do with the one you got. I can't keep track of the one I got. That's a lifetime. You know what I've said? One time I said this, and I can't remember where I was at. I said, you know, my job, God put me on this earth to straighten out Sister Lynn. And just as soon as I get finished straightening out myself, I'm going to get started on her. I'm still working on myself, but when I get done, I get myself straightened out just like I want, man, I'm coming after. It's been almost 23 years now coming up, and I'm just about halfway done with myself. So I'll give her another 20 or 30 years, and then I'll probably be good enough I can start working on her. I can finally straighten her out, have the time to work on that. But I don't want to be the husband of more than one wife, and I don't know if that means more than one wife at a time. Really doesn't matter. The point is, you can't commit adultery and things like that and still remain a minister of God. You can't, I can't divorce my wife for no good reason because she doesn't cook well or I'm tired of her or we fight all the time. All that kind of stuff. God says, no, sorry, it just doesn't work that way. You cannot do that. He allows, you know, a very narrow scope of reasons where your wife could depart and you could divorce. And again, that's the wife that would depart. Or the verse, that's true. The husband could depart and the wife would be just fine. I've known of instances where that occurred with our ministry, where the minister departed and, you know, his former wife is just fine and she's a good member of standing. So those are some things that might be a little disconcerting. Now, in recounting the history of Israel and what went on, what he says is, look, I'm not asking you to memorize all this stuff and just walk this straight and narrow with all these little set of rules. Remember, we say here at Camp Creek, the New Testament church is not about following a set of rules. Why? Because if you're doing that, you're on a performance-based religion. It's performance-based. You're trying to make sure that you do enough every day. You perform, you accomplish enough that God will be pleased and you'll be justified in his sight. We are not on a performance base. We are not on the treadmill of religion. Do not do that. There are, of course, heretical doctrines, heretics who have put forth an idea, and that's what it leads to. That's what they're talking about. We often refer to them as legalists or Pharisees. Why do we do that? Because they want to get into the same thing that Moses was talking about here. There's all these little rules about this and that, whether you can do this or do that. In order for you to be a super Jew, of course, in our day, it's order for you to be a super Christian or have or to have a closer relationship with your Lord. There's all kinds of really neat euphemisms that you might hear, but it's all based on your performance and whether or not you measure up. Every last bit of it. If you're not doing this, if you don't get up every morning, spend at least 30 minutes in prayer and meditation every morning of your natural life, then you're not a super Christian. And your relationship with God is not flourishing. See stuff like that? It's performance-based, whether or not you perform. Goodness gracious, I've woke up some mornings with strep throat, and I don't do a whole lot of anything. You know? So I missed that morning, and God's going to hold me accountable for that? No. He says, you're a vile sinner anyway. You get sick. That's why I got to come take care of you and whatnot. Sister Lynn, don't listen to his moaning. He's like that. So the Lord understands all that. That's not performance. We're not on performance-based religion. If we are, I told Brother John, I said, the only time I will accept a statement like that is if you talk solely and exclusively about the performance of Jesus Christ. If you'll do that, then yeah, I'll sign up. Outside of that, count me out. I don't want a part of it. Why? Because I fail too much. I cannot live up to it, and I try it. And you know what? There's dear brothers and sisters that are caught in that trap. It's my job as a minister, and it's your job too, but it's my job as a minister is to try to save them, to recover that, because they are headed for a fall sooner or later. And I would like to help them before they get there, but sooner or later, of their own making, because again, following what the Lord tells you to do is for your good. They're not following what the Lord tells you to do. What does the Lord tell you to do? He says, look, it's not that difficult. He says, I want you to fear the Lord thy God. I want you to walk in all his ways. I want you to love him. And I want you to serve the Lord thy God with all the heart, mind, and soul. What's he telling you? He said, look, fear the Lord thy God. Just respect the Lord. Respect God. Just respect me that I know what I'm doing. He's asking you, he says, look, I've given you some instruction. I've given you a place to park yourself and your family. I've given you a place to worship. I've given you brothers and sisters. I've given you some structure. And I've given you a way to kind of keep it peaceful. I've given you a way to keep it where you enjoy all the good blessings and benefits of the New Testament kingdom and of the Lord. I've given you information about Jesus Christ so that you know your relationship is not based on your performance. I've given you a gospel, which is good news, that says it doesn't matter about your performance. Jesus Christ, based on his blood, I'll love you forever. From everlasting unto everlasting, your relationship me cannot change. Your relationship will not diminish the least bit because it's based on Jesus Christ, not you. That's the gospel message in a nutshell. That's it, to get you off that performance-based deal. So respect me when I tell you something. Walk in all his ways. He just say, be doers of the word, not hearers only. Sitting in church, hearing it is great. Doing it is better. Jesus Christ says, if you love me, then keep my commandments. Why? Because they're good for you. They're good for you to keep your commandments. It allows you to enjoy the blessings that are yours already. Love him. Real simple. Prioritize your life. Prioritize your life and then ingrain that priority in your life. Ingrain it within you that you naturally do stuff. I'll give you examples of people that do that. And you serve the Lord God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and thy mind. That's the hardest one. All he's saying is surrender it all. Just give up. Just throw your hands in the air and say, I can't do it by myself. I can't do it my way. I am not as smart as I think I am. Okay? Just surrender it all, and you join yourself to a group of people that have already surrendered their all, that's already given up everything, and say, you know what? We're going to do it the way the Lord tells us to do it. Not because we don't know what we're doing, it's because we know we don't know what we're doing. Follow that? People who think they know what they're doing, they don't realize how ignorant they are. I know how ignorant almost I am. There's still probably some I don't know that the Lord is trying to reveal to me. When he does, that's more for me to surrender and say, you know what? I don't know how to run my finances the way I think I know how to run my finances. Here's how I need to run my finances. Why don't I go back to Proverbs and start reading a little bit about what the Lord tells me to do and the guidance he gives me on borrowing and things like that. So that's what the Lord tells us to do. Now, we're running out of time, so I want to wrap up just real quick. You know, I noted that the Old Testament had the Ten Commandments. You know how many of those Ten Commandments actually carry forward into the New Testament church? All of them. Either directly or indirectly, they're referenced in the New Testament scriptures. Jesus Christ himself being the one that referenced them the most. He referenced the Sabbath day. And you say, well, wait a minute, that's a Jewish tradition about religion. No, actually, Jesus Christ set them straight. This is not about religion. It's about your health. It is about the way you live your life. Jesus Christ says, look, the Sabbath day, that he says, look, man, because, you know, the Sabbath came from the creation, the first, you know, 6 days, and then God rested the seventh, call it the Sabbath, make it holy, and said, y'all guys got to rest too. That's what he said. It's real simple. God says, look, I worked for 6 days creating the entire universe. I rested the seventh. Y'all do too. Y'all do the same thing. Follow my example. You can work 6 days, but I need you to rest on the seventh day. Remember that. Keep the Sabbath. Do that. Why? So you don't use up all your margins. So you don't burn the candle at both ends. So you don't wear yourself out. That's all the Lord's trying to tell you. Jesus Christ set people straight because they thought that was a religious holiday of some kind. He said, look, man was not created for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was created for man. That's what Jesus Christ says. Look, and then he said, look, is it wrong to show mercy or to show love or to do something good for someone on the Sabbath? Is that what you're telling me? That this day is so holy and it's such a religious holiday that you won't show love and mercy to your brothers and sisters because it's the Sabbath and you're scared you'll be doing servile work? Is that your problem? No. This day was made for you, you not for it. And there's nothing wrong in the eyes of the Lord with you showing mercy on the Sabbath day. If you were to go by and visit someone who was sick, if on Sunday afternoon, well, actually it's Saturday, on Saturday afternoon, if you were to go by and mow the lawn of some widow who is not able to do that and just tend to her needs because you're doing work on that day and you're Jewish, you're good to go because you're showing mercy and you're showing love and there's nothing wrong with that. And you are serving one another. And never, that's what Jesus Christ said, there is never a day where you can't serve one another. Same way I always like to say, you know, Sabbath day was a day of worship set aside for the Jews. What's the legal authorized day for us New Testament Christians to worship? I said, we have a legal authorized day where we are allowed to worship. It's any day that ends in Y. So I always say that. Now, all those were carried forward, but here's what we need. We don't need more rules. We don't need more quantity of rules in the New Testament. We need more powerful rules. Why? Because now, as we read the New Testament, the devil is as a roaring lion walking to and fro, seeing whom he may devour. Satan's on to us. He understands. When he saw that the Lord was crucified, when he saw the Lord resurrected, he knows what's up. He's on to us now. And now it's not so much a battle for eating the wrong thing or not eating the wrong thing. It's a battle for your very soul. It's a battle to turn you away so you don't enjoy the blessings of God. It's a battle to upset your life. So that battle has gotten way more aggressive in our day than it ever was in the days of the Jews. So what do we need? More laws? No. We need more powerful laws. The laws that Jesus Christ gives us, the laws that you found in the New Testament. And the one that I want to go back to and end up on is the same type of thing, was something that we read on our Wednesday night service in Micah. In Micah chapter 6, here's what Micah the prophet said. Same type of thing. He says, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Micah asks this question. Is the Lord pleased with thousands of rams as a sacrifice or oils given as a sacrifice? Would he be pleased if I were to give my firstborn as a sacrifice for the sins and transgression of my soul? Would the Lord be pleased in that? And the answer is no. He has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with the Lord our God. If you're ready to walk humbly with the Lord our God, you want to surrender all, you come and join us, and we'll receive you as we stand and sing 282.